This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Ariel Zatina. Ariel Zatina is a Chicago-based DJ, music producer, writer, and performance artist. Her play, Gerrymanderia, premiered last month as part of Burning Coal Theater's 19th Amendment Project. A staple on the club scene, Zatina tells me that being a trans woman of color, along with her Belizean heritage, informs what she creates. And that is where our conversation begins.
For me, just growing up with Belizean heritage, I don't see a lot of narratives around being Belizean or being a trans woman of color. And so I think for my music and for my writing, those two things are really, really important to me, especially with music, because Belize has so many unique genres of music that aren't really super well known for most of the world. So I'm always like, because I am Belizean and because I got to grow up with these really specific types of music, I always feel like it's really important to incorporate it into my work.
I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the unrest that's happened in Chicago, in your city. How does music and art help you navigate or even reconcile the tumult going on around you?
I feel so lucky to have a community here, and there's so much work and so much art being made, and a lot of the same people that are making this work and making this art are some of the leaders in the movements that are happening here, and there is so much overlap of artists and activists. So, I think that for me, I've really been trying to focus on how am I making work that is able to have community participation in it. And I think that for me, that is really, it's always difficult in the pandemic to do that. But I think that, that's been really my goal, being a playwright and also being a musician. Like, I am also trying to learn patience in the process, and I'm really trying to develop and like, what is the most important work right now, and what is the most important work over, the next 4 or 5 years, for example, the next 3 years even. I feel figuring out exactly what the artist's role is in this time.
I love the fact that you said that, because not only are artists trying to figure out what role the arts play during this time, but we're also changing the way we make art as well. Everything is virtual and on screens. And I feel like that is part of the challenge of the process right now for so many artists.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's almost funny to come back to, because I primarily started in theater and then got frustrated with a lot of things in theater. And one of them was, I think, it not being sort of embracing of the electronic and embracing of the digital. There's this idea that there's so much opportunity for one thing to happen or for simultaneous things to happen in theater. And I think that just being able to imagine things digitally, being able to, I'm already imagining things so digitally. So I was like, when I was sort of met with like, oh, this is going to be a live stream, I was like, oh, this is actually amazing. Like, I feel like I actually have a lot of references to how this can be done and this can work.
So I want you to talk to me about the pageantry of politics and the impetus of using the Miss Universe pageant as the centerpiece of your play, Gerrymanderia.
Yeah, I was initially after doing sort of the initial research on the 19th Amendment, a lot of what I sort of turned to was, I was actually watching a lot of the Masked Singer, because I was like, this feels so Hunger Games to me in a way, that there's these celebrities in these outfits and the audience is voting for which one is a better singer without knowing who they are, and how a lot of you know, drag pageantry, and then also the whole pageant system is, you know, televised, and it's this sort of the same thing. And these, this idea of like watching a voting process has become such a sort of way for people to participate, and sort of, it becomes like a fun thing. Like there's so many times we're voting on the internet all the time. We're doing that sort of things. I'm obsessed with pageant drag queens. I'm obsessed with Miss Universe pageants. I always think about how I went to my high school had pageants. Like there's beauty pageants at my high school that you would go and see who would win Miss Nice and who would compete against all the other high schools and who would, like, you know, that was something that was so ingrained culturally in me growing up outside of Jacksonville. And, you know, I'm also so obsessed just like that the word pageantry comes from this idea of literally like passion plays and the passion of the Christ and the passion of Easter, and like these are the stories that are telling and these are the narratives. And yeah, I mean, it feels just so, you know, watching the debates this year, it's just so crazy to see how, like, just the difference in sort of the aesthetic of the debates, and seeing how everything seems like it's almost been through a BuzzFeed filter, and how it's been affected by that sort of aesthetic of things. And how we're making a debate as a TV program. It needs to be flashy. The artistry that goes into it is so fascinating to me.
Is there any connection in the fact that our reality show president is also the owner of a pageant?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think that, like, it makes so much sense. It's almost uncanny. It's ridiculous. Yeah, that's the thing. It's just like, you know, obviously, Trump is someone that he so represents this idea of the American dream to people. And I feel like beauty pageants are very that in so many ways as well, which is also why I love drag pageants, because again, it's subverting this thing. And it's like, there's no age limit. Like, you know, a 65-year-old woman will be competing against like a 20-year-old. And it's so much about this idea of making your own beauty and not relying on, you know, certain standards of beauty, you know, even though there's so many standards in and then sort of even just like the other layer of that, of a lot of drag queens really rebelling against the pageant system in this idea of also rejecting that system.
And I think too, to your point, especially looking at it through the lens of the Black Lives Matter movement and everything we're seeing right now, there is kind of a whitewashing in so many of these pageants and how we define what beauty is. So I love that this is so layered. Talk to me a little bit about the character of Jerry Mandaria.
This character is so inspired by, I think it's sort of a mixture of the Alien and the Fifth Element, this sort of singing opera, and this idea that I am watching RuPaul's Drag Race every week for so many weeks. There was a time during the pandemic that it was coming. There was 3.5 hours of drag every Friday of like, and just nonstop in a row. So me and all my friends were literally on Zoom together watching 3.5 hours of drag every night. And like, then, you know, you can tweet and like vote who should win. And it's this live thing where it's like, you know, all of it is being also recorded during the pandemic as well. One of the voting systems I was a part of is this drag voting system. And I was like, okay, like this character for me is just a representation of me being like, yes, I have to get my vote in for this queen. Like she has to win because she is the best one. In a lot of ways, it feels like, I imagine this is how people care about sports, is the way I care about RuPaul's Drag Race and the way I care about drag. It's the same sort of feeling, I think. The biggest thing for me that I really was thinking about that is such a, I think the other big influence of this play is that, this amendment that it's like this idea that I feel like they teach you in school, that is all people can vote. Everyone's representation matters. And I think about, for example, how many how many people who have been charged with a felony, how many women that have been charged with a felony don't get to vote, and how, you know, that this sort of idea of everyone can vote comes with, you know, voter suppression is also, there's this permanent voter suppression that exists in the US as well. And just, you know, how, you know, I think we're seeing in this movement, for example, like how many marijuana charges are getting overturned. And I just think about how many felonies are like that, where like, at what point does someone else get to decide what constitutes who gets to vote and who doesn't?
So true. And as I do these interviews with so many of the playwrights involved in this 19th Amendment project, so much of the dialogue is turning to the fact that the entire suffragist movement was rooted in racism. I, as a trans woman, where do trans women, especially trans women of color, fit into the narrative of the women's rights movement?
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, I always go back to thinking about, you know, for example, how much the term TERF, trans exclusionary radical feminist, is sort of thrown around to there, or not thrown around, you know, people are also talking about it from like a, but that, you know, that term originally comes from this idea of a gay cisgender woman that doesn't feel like a trans woman can be part of this second wave of feminism because of her genitalia and the fact that she wasn't born with a doctor saying that she is a woman when she's born. So it's really interesting to me that this, like, what is now being used as sort of a word against mostly heterosexual cis women that are anti-trans now is actually a term that was rooted in a separation within the queer community and a wanting for part of the gay community to not let in transgender women. I think that, you know, it's difficult for transgender women of color to be able to, for example, I think about how I imagine that there were very few transgender women of color at the Women's March that happened in Chicago a couple years ago, mostly because of this trend of the pussy hats. I mean, these pink pussy hats are a lot of women are wearing them and not thinking about how this isn't inclusive of the genitalia of all women, and how also for some people, you know, a vagina doesn't represent something that is female at all. It's such a subject right now because of politics and what's happening. But, you know, I think that what's been amazing is that seeing the trans march that happened in New York, maybe I think it was about a month ago or so, that was organized, where there was 15,000 people all there for Black transgender women. I mean, transgender women of color are all affected, but it's really Black transgender women, especially Black transgender sex workers, that are most affected by these issues. Yeah, so it's complicated, of course. You know, I think it's really amazing to see how many allies there really are in the movement, and how many people are really recognizing what it really means to be a feminist these days. I always like to, you know, whenever I'm sort of talking about stuff like this, there's this sort of idea of that a lot of people who don't recognize trans women as women feel that there's, you know, this sort of male privilege that like has existed or still exists for trans women. And, you know, I think that the thing that is never sort of talked about is that, like, you know, growing up as a transgender woman and growing up as a transgender girl and growing up as a cisgender girl are just, you know, there's a lot of different stuff about the experiences, as there are also a lot of similarities. We can see, sometimes I think it's hard to see that, we can all have different experiences, but also be part of the same group. And I think that for me is always, a big thing that I'm always thinking about and stuff. And I feel like trans women and cis women have so many opportunities to learn from each other. And I always really appreciate, you know, being able to know that, you know, when cis women and trans women are allies with each other, I think it's always really beautiful.
It's also been such a catastrophic year when it comes to gender-based crimes, especially crimes against trans women and trans women of color. Do you feel like things are getting any better for trans women? I mean, on the one hand, we have these reality shows, like you mentioned, RuPaul's Drag Race, and shows like Pose that are addressing trans issues. And then on the other hand, we have these hate crimes that I feel like are being shoved under the rug and taking a back seat to everything else that's going on right now. So are things getting any better?
It's such a complicated question. I mean, I definitely will probably be frank and say, no, you know, I don't feel like they are getting better. I think a lot of the, I think that in the long term, we will maybe see things to get better. But for me, I think it's kind of hard to say. I think that for me, I always think about how I feel really blessed that there are, you know, that there are people in my life who are watching, who are watching Pose and who are really like, who are really paying attention to the representation that's happening. The representation has been so amazing. Like being able to see the girls on Pose has been like the most, that like seeing the first season of Pose was such a life-changing experience. And I feel so amazed that I get to be able to live in a time where there's this much trans representation in the media. But you know, I think for me, and this is going a little off topic, and then I'll go back to sort of the reality. But I think that Disclosure, the documentary that just came out on Netflix, has been really earth-shattering, and that's been the thing that I've been telling everybody to go watch. Because for example, it's all totally about the representation of media, but for example, it shows maybe about 12 or 13 movies where the reaction to seeing like a trans woman's body is to vomit. And it's this thing that's been ingrained in this culture, and a lot of the gender-based violence that's happening to trans women of color is from this idea of being in sexual situations and having the sort of the thing that's been defined as trans panic is the thing that is, you know, still in many states, like someone can go in and have killed a trans woman and say that it was trans panic and be able to get away freely. That's been luckily changing in a lot of states, but that's like a huge thing that that is something that needs to be. But you know, it's hard for me to feel like that this will get better, because I think that those media stereotypes are still so ingrained. I mean, you know, Trump just changed the national ruling of what it means to be a woman as like using the term biologically male, which is so problematic because it again is gender essentialist, assumes that if you have a penis, you are a man. And I think that, you know, I think that we still have a long way to go, specifically between moving from allowing trans women into all of our spaces freely versus also allowing, you know, trans amory to be something that is freely practiced, and people, you know, people aren't going to call these men gay for being attracted to a woman, because it's, you know, it's these things that transphobia and homophobia are so intertwined and so interconnected. And a lot of times this gender-based violence is actually happening because of homophobia and also our ideas of what a trans woman is. You know, I think about, for me, for example, as someone who travels constantly for my job, a lot of the really craziest times that I think about how my life is affected in these situations where, for example, using a bathroom at a airport is such a difficult thing for me. And for me, like, I always operate where I don't make eye contact with anyone else. I don't look at anyone else because, you know, there's this idea that if someone clocks me in the bathroom, like, they're going to kick me out. I think it's also something where people always, there's this idea that trans people and children can't be in the same bathrooms because of all of these preconceived notions of, like, you know, these ideas of, like, male pedophiles dressing as women and going into bathrooms to, like, take pictures of young girls, all of this shit. And I just think about how, you know, you're traveling, a bathroom is such a time when it's so necessary to just, like, relax for a second from, like, a hectic day. And it's these little things that happen every day to me that are the things that just add up that make everything so difficult. And, you know, I feel really lucky that, that these things are getting talked about now, but I just, you know, it's, I just, you know, I just get so, I think about how, like, any day, like, I, you know, it's my amount of, you know, my amount of degrees of separation from these women who are dying is usually one. I usually know someone who knows one of the girls that has died. And, you know, it's just, it's really wild. The community is so small. It's, you know, I have so many trans women friends in so many different cities, in so many different countries. So many girls that I know from the internet exclusively, we've never even met. But yeah, the network is there. And I just really, you know, I think it's going to take a lot to change, but yes, but I do think things are getting better. I always hate being like, no, they're not getting better, but they are. I just think that, the reality is still very grim.
I also want to talk about cancel culture a little bit. Can you talk to me about cancel culture and this idea of calling out versus calling in and how that relates to the women's movement?
Yeah, it's such a complicated thing. And I also am really an advocate of this, this idea of calling in versus calling out. For me, I always feel like, in a lot of ways, I felt really the cancel culture is a myth for some people, and that's why it feels like it is problematic to me. I think about the way that for example, and I won't go into in this too much, but I had a public call out of my abuser, but, you know, my abuser still works fully, you know, in the, you know, there were certain places that they may not work now because of what I said, but in the largest thing, you know, things, you know, there's a new person to cancel every moment, and people move on very quickly, and you know, a canceling is sort of arbitrary. It's like, what community is canceling? Who's canceled? Like, there are millions of communities that exist. There's always other people. There's always other things that anybody can do. And, you know, I just think, I mean, this is sort of the most dramatic example of this, but I always think about this. I think about the public's difference in their perception of calling out Bill Cosby or calling out R. Kelly versus calling out someone like Dr. Luke, who, you know, Dr. Luke is still has number one songs on the radio currently right now, even though he has, you know, he's been someone that's been called out by so many people for sexual assault. And I just think about the sheer difference that it feels like race has a lot to do with that a lot of the times. And our willingness to cancel people of color seems much greater than our willingness to cancel a white person, for example. I think for me, I always, I'm really, you know, thinking about the people who I'm surrounding myself with, it's important for me that I feel safe and that I feel protected and that also my community feels protected so that, you know, if I know that someone is not going to feel safe, that is someone that is frequenting my parties and going to my parties, or if I think that someone is not going to be safe, I think that I've always sort of believed in handling things privately. But in a lot of times, I think that people refuse to listen if things happen privately, especially, you know, I think about how important, for example, Mickey Blanco, who is a trans femme artist, was not getting paid by Teyana Taylor for a heavy feature on one of her songs. And it literally took, you know, Mickey calling out this to her, like, you know, thousands of followers and having a million people tag Teyana Taylor in order for this to happen. And so it just becomes a necessity at some point, especially when it has to do with people getting paid and people having money. I think about, you know, just the unfortunate shit that is happening with the group formerly known as Lady Antebellum suing Lady A for the use of her name, even though they're blatantly stealing and they're colonizing another person's name. You know, I think it's really insane. And I think the stuff, I think when people are using their powers in this ways, it's really scary. I think a lot of time too, again, not to bring out Drag Race again, but I also think it has to do with this. I think about the way that after something bad happens on Drag Race, you know, I have people who are my friends getting a million messages of hate speech every day, and people, you know, young gay people sending messages of hate to other young gay people, and just the problematic sort of nature of like what culture turns into in this way. And it's this, you know, the newest gossip, the newest TMZ is cancel culture now. And I think that is problematic that there is a fetishizing of it. I think we're maybe probably better off for living in a period of it, but we have to look for it. I think we have to look at it with a grain of salt.
Because of everything we've been talking about, do you feel like there is an immediacy or an urgency to your work, not just as a playwright, but as a music producer and creator?
Yeah, I mean, I've been shocked to learn when people kind of are outed as, especially young people that I've known for years, like just shocked when I find out someone who's so close to me is like, you know, is supporting Trump. I think that I forget sometimes. I mean, I don't forget. I mean, I think last time I went to where I'm from, like just seeing the sheer difference with how Chicago and how Jacksonville shares their like love of Trump. But you know, at the end of the day too, I think what's been the most amazing thing that I've seen this year is really just the radical people in Jacksonville really fighting for Black lives there and really fighting for LGBT people there. And just, you know, somewhere that was so awful to me in so many ways growing up has been somewhere that has been filled with just like the energy is there, and it's amazing. It makes me really, really, really just like hopeful.
Because of everything we've been talking about, do you feel that there is an urgency and an immediacy to your work, not just as a playwright involved in this 19th Amendment project, but as a music artist and producer?
Yes and no. I think that what I've realized is that a lot of the work I need to do as an artist right now is not necessarily making work. Like, I think there's a lot of artists that should be doing the work that's making, lending their practice to the front lines and really making the work. I think for me right now, what I've really been focusing on is a continued look at decolonizing my art practice and how that is something that is really important, as well as decentering of my art practice, kind of how my work can be more community oriented. And I think that for me, that is a longer process. And I feel like the immediacy of working and doing process and being creative to me is there, but not necessarily the immediacy of like showing my work. What I will say though, is that I feel like I, you know, for example, what I do think that is the most big of active work that's the biggest changing is that I think as a community organizer and as someone who, you know, a lot of what my work is in the city and especially in Chicago is, you know, most of the time when I'm in Chicago, I'm doing the organizing. I might be playing a set and I might be DJing in Chicago, but I'm mostly the one doing the booking and the one doing the organizing. And I think for me, you know, that's been interesting because it's all live stream now, so it's very different. But I think that I have, you know, I think that for me, it's like, it's really been about uplifting others' work more so than uplifting my own art. But I feel like that's part of my art too. I feel like organizing is a creative process, and that is, it all feels connected.
The Burning Coal Theater production of Jerry Mandaria is available to view virtually through September 30th. I'll put a link to Burning Coal's website in the episode notes. Zetina's latest EP, MUAs at the End of the World, is available to stream now on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon Music. If you like what you've heard, please consider subscribing to the podcast, become a patron of the show, follow us on social media at RDU On Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.